The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following. This is Captain Dallas Lee. I'm here to tell you about Adam and Eve. That's right. I'm talking about the great story, Garden of Eden. That's what you got to be talking about right now. Thank you very much.
I don't think that's actually the Adam and Eve they're talking about. I think it's more of the fun kind.
What, talk about fun kind? That's fun to the captain. I love talking about that.
No. More of like the fun, spicy things that could probably happen in your bedroom.
Oh, spicy stuff. Spicy stuff happens in different rooms in the captain's place. That's right. Out there in the kitchen, I got me a big old mess of chili going right now. Nice and spicy. Nice and hot, too. Hot and spicy. That's what Captain likes it. You like it hot and spicy?
Well, of course I do, but not too spicy.
You can't take the heat, can you? For Adam and Eve, it's a beautiful story to tell you about right now, but you're talking about a different kind of Adam and Eve, ain't you?
I am, indeed.
Is it kind of an Adam and Eve where you can get free stuff?
Oh, it is indeed. Free stuff is awesome. Go to adamandeve.com. Enter the offer code NECRO at the checkout and get 10 tantalizing free gifts.
10 tentacles?
No, tantalizing.
Oh, tantalizing. My bad. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
A sexy item for him, a special gift for her, and a third item you'll both enjoy. Yes!
Both of us, my goddamn. No. It's all about the captain here. I don't worry about the other stuff there. She can worry about that on her own.
No. It's all about sharing.
Sharing? Well, I'm going to share some of that chili a little bit later on. Could also get 6 free spicy movies. Wait, spicy movies? Talk about spicy movies?
Well, I'm sure it's an Adam and Eve story, but it's going to be spicy.
Well, I like getting free stuff. The captain likes getting free stuff. We're talking about Adam and Eve. That's right. Free stuff to spice up your bedroom is even better. Select almost any one item for almost 50% off. Wait, are you kidding me? They want 50%?
Don't forget to enter the offer code NECRO at your checkout and get 10 tantalizing free gifts at adamandeve.com.
Plus free shipping. That's NECRO. NECRO at adamandeve.com. Thank you very much.
Hey, Scott. Happy Labor Day.
What's up, man? Hey, hold on, dude. I'm laboring. Give me a minute.
Okay. Hey, Dan. Happy Labor Day.
Breathe.
I'm not in labor. I'm laboring.
Happy Labor Day to you too, kind sir.
Hey, Walt. Happy Labor Day.
Hey, don't go Labor Day yourself.
And guess what? We have somebody with us.
Who we got?
We got Lisa Vasquez with us.
Lisa!
Yay! Little Muppet Show entrance there.
Yes.
Say hi to everybody, Lisa.
Hello, everybody. Happy Labor Day. Back.
Happy Day of Labor to you.
There's a reason that Lisa's with us right now, guys. That's because.
Is it because the cockroach traps are still keeping Skip Novak out?
Yes. Yes.
Because nobody else wanted to do it.
Oh! Fuck.
My scaredy cat panelists. We're hiding, and I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And hopefully, I don't fall asleep beforehand because it's a little late. But that's all right.
Well, this week we have a very special Necrocast account for our listeners. It is the Scares That Care 6 Stitch Smile Publications reading and presentation that was on Saturday night, and a whole bunch of talent from Stitch Smile Publication read a little bit of things that they had, like Mike Duke, Pete Molnar, A.J. Brown, Donnell Party Whiting, Lisa Vasquez. Did I miss anybody?
Yourself.
Oh, me. Yes. Yes, myself as well. I read from Good Boy, my forthcoming book. And it's really cool. But before we get into all of that, I'm going to remind you that you can sponsor the NecroCastingCon. Can you not, Scott?
Absolutely. You do that by going to projectentertainmentnetwork.com. You click on the advertising banner on the home page, and right there you get all the information you need to know about becoming a sponsor and advertising your business right here on this podcast. While you're on the website, check out the merchandise store. You can grab yourself some cool NecroCasticon swag or swag of any of the podcasts on the network. But the best way to show support for all your podcasts is by going to patreon.com/projectentnet. Sign up today to become a patron. It's only $1 a month for the base package, but the more you give, the more you get, because the more you contribute, the better the awards are to you as a patron.
Yeah, like, so if you're at the $3 level, you can get You Gotta Be Kidding, or You Gotta Be Fucking Kidding Me, the podcast that I do with our friend Skip Novak, Cockroach Traps, you know, to the side there. Skip's a cool dude, and we debunk we debunk conspiracy theories on the podcast, and you can get that at the $3 level when it comes out, and you know, a couple weeks later when it trickles down to the $1 level, you can listen to it there.
So for $3, you can tell me if the Earth is flat?
No, the Earth is not flat, Lisa.
What?
The Earth is not flat.
I can't wait to be a guest on this show. So
yeah, I know. Jeez.
Coming soon, Dan. Coming soon. All right.
Reptilian people. Reptilians.
Scarce at Care 6 was a blast. I talked about it a couple weeks ago with Skip on the show here, and we just had a great time there. And somebody else had a great time there, too, and that was Lisa and the rest of the Stitch Smile Publications crew, was it not?
It was amazing.
And I think the rumor has it that we're going to try to have Stitched Row, hashtag Stitched Row, next year, where a whole row of the vendor room is people involved with Stitch Smile.
Yeah, so we already have our table for next year.
Nice.
And I talked to them and I said, hey, we may have a couple other authors that are just doing their own independent table, but they are part of Stitch Smile. So, you know, if you guys are cool with it, we'd like, and they agree to it, we'd like to have everybody just in a right next to each other. So quietly and sneakily, because, you know, they won't hear this, right?
Right.
It's great. Yeah. So quietly and sneakily, we are going to form Stitched Row.
Yes. If we can. She gets big giant smiley face spider to hang over everybody as they walk down with cobwebs dripping on them. Yeah. Creepy stuff. All right. But,
cobwebs drip. Cobwebs drip.
They can if they're soaked in blood, Walter.
Oh, yes. Right.
All right. So we on Saturday night we did the readings.
Mm-hmm.
Since you're the CEO of Stitch Smile Publications, I'm going to turn this over to you to introduce those readings.
Okay, so the readings were done, as you said, by Donnell Party Whiting. She did a reading from Strigoi that she co-wrote with Michael Freeman. Then we had Peter Molnar. He did Broken Birds. We had A.J. Brown, who read from Dredging Up Memories.
And he had the bear with him.
Yes, he had Humphrey with him, and Humphrey was getting all the love. I think even got kisses from Jonathan Mayberry. And then we had, of course, Tommy did his reading from Good Boy, and then Mike Duke did a reading from Where the Gods Sleep, and then I did a snippet from The Unfleshed.
Yeah, and I cringed.
I think Tommy squirmed a little bit during.
Yeah, it was rather emasculating.
Why? What, emasculating? Details, emasculating. Come on.
Yeah. You know how you felt when you watched the movie Teeth, knowing that what's going to happen to the dudes? Yeah. That's the same feeling you get when you hear this thing that Lisa read.
Nice. I get people say that it reminded them of Serpent in the Rainbow.
That too.
Mm-hmm. Why are they burying me? I'm not dead.
I'm not dead.
All right. So,
that's all I remember from that movie, in the trailer as a kid growing up. My parents never let me watch it.
That was
I just remember
shit.
That one part. Why are they burying me? I'm not dead. They gave me nightmares.
Things nightmares are made of. And here's a few more nightmares to instill in you guys as we have the Stitch Smile Publications readings from Scary Care 6 for your listening pleasure.
So most of you are familiar faces. But hi. Thank you for coming. We are Stitch Smile Publications. I am Lisa Vasquez. I am the CEO. I'm going to do introductions in a little bit, but I want to tell you a little bit about us and who we are. We've started Stitch Smile Publications in January of 2016. So we've been around for just a couple years. We're still in the infancy of who we are. And in that time, we have published, I think I've forgotten how many people we published, which is good, right? We have a anthology that we put out. Our first big anthology that we put out has Ramsey Campbell, Nicholas Vince, Josh Mallerman, and some other really good names out there. And we started with taking authors who maybe don't know the industry very well, and we gave them a place that they could call home, and we called the House of Stitch. So what we believe in is mentoring, teaching people how to market, how to brand themselves, and giving them some kind of light in the dark to either take it to the next level or to stay and call it home forever. So I'm going to go ahead and go down the line, and everybody can introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Danelle Hardy Whiting. I'm the editor-in-chief at Stitch Smile. I've been with it since the beginning. Well, maybe the beginning minus 1 week. Lisa and I have the similar viewpoint on how things should go through before they are published, which makes me really happy because I don't have to fight her. And I'm also an author. When I first started, I co-authored Strigoi and another book called Strychnine, and I have some short stories. Now I'm working on some projects of my own, in addition to making sure that everybody else's words just shine brighter than the sun.
I am the new guy. I'm Tom Clark. I'm a writer, podcasting engineer, musician, DJ, do everything, jack all trades. Last year I came on board, met Lisa here at Scares That Care, and I thought outside the box. I was looking for a publisher, and I printed out a draft of the book I had written, and I walked up to her and I handed it to her and I said, wouldn't this look sexier with a Stitch Smiles logo on it?
Verbatim.
She's looking at it and she's flipping through, and my wonderful wife, who's out in the audience, won a bunch of money at a casino and paid for art to put in the book. And that caught her eye. And now she's my teacher. So I'm happy to be here, and I'm going to be, you know, talking about something from that book tonight with you guys. So, Pete?
Lisa's my teacher, too. I met Lisa when she took me under her wing as my mentor through Horror Writers Association. She took a look at my work. I also showed it to Mr. Jeff Brown. And when it passed inspection, I went. And then they decided to take me on as one of their VIP authors. And it was probably one of the happiest days of my life. It was a long road. And I had to give myself a lot of pep talks to stay in the game. But Stitched left me no choice but to stay in the game and to up it every day. I'm a musician too, author, high school teacher, giver of F's when they're required. but again, I'm just happy to be here. So.
I am AJ Brown. I have been here since the beginning when Lisa was forming Stitch Smile Publications. I am an author. I write what I call horror with heart. I am not a musician. I cannot sing. You do not want me to sing. Trust me. And Pete don't give himself enough props. He's a damn fine writer. And so that's all I got.
We're missing somebody who's hiding in the back. So I'm going to ask him to step up here because these are all familiar faces. You can do it. Come on.
I'm Mike Duke. I've been with Stitch since 2016. Lisa picked up my novel, Loaf. That was my first big thing that got published. And since then, she's worked with me on other books and been a tremendous help and mentor in getting pulling more out of me. And so I've had four other books published with Stitch Smile. So, two novellas and three novels. I'm glad to be there.
Also in our audience, we have our editor, Tara, my editor and personal assistant, Larissa, and Deanna, and then we have our honorary mascot, Joan. Yay, Joan. So we decided to do a little something special for you, but before we do that, I'm gonna tell you a little bit more about myself. I'm also an author. I came into the industry as wet behind the ears as everybody does. I didn't just plop out and become a publisher. What I found was that there can be some bad blood amongst people, and so It's warranted, trust me, because you put a lot into people, and sometimes when you do that and you mentor and you give and you give and give, if they don't return it or at least be thankful for it, it gives people a bad taste in their mouth. But I'm stubborn, and so I decided that, you know, if I'm going to ask authors for help, I need to give something in return. So I started out doing what I do best, and that was marketing and book covers. So I started out with Mark Tufo. Anybody know Mark Tufo? Mm-hmm. Mark Tufo did a Zombie Fallout series. You know Mark Tufo, right, Tommy? Okay. So he did do a podcast for a little while with Armand. Right?
Mm-hmm. We won't talk about that
anymore. We're just mentioning. So I started with him. I also helped Steve Stahlcup with his WordPress and helping that. And so I guess what I'm trying to say with that story is that sometimes in order to get something, you got to give something of yourself. And that's what we do with our company as well. That's what we believe in. Okay. So I'm an author. I wrote The Unfleshed, Tale of the Toxic Bride, The Author of the Unsaintly. I have a bunch of short stories on it. If anybody's familiar with Kevin Kennedy's series, I have book covers with him. I did a lot of Mike Evans book covers, most of the Stitch Smile covers, and that was my gift to anybody who helped me. I was helping them out with book covers because what I believed was that, you know, just because you're coming into the indie world doesn't mean that you have to be by yourself, and sometimes a good story needs a good cover, and we can't always afford that. So I said, you know what? I'm going to give some affordable prices and help people out, and then help formatting, help all that, and to wrap the story up, basically what happened was somebody said, you should be a publisher. And I was like, what? I'm trying to learn this game myself. So I interned with another company for 1 year. That set the basis for our company. Everybody who comes in is an intern for 1 year, because either you're going to run away screaming or you're going to stay and love it. And that's who we are. So your treat tonight is that in order for us to tell you a little bit about who we are, we're going to read you some of our work. So who's going first?
I'll go first. I have no problems going first.
You go first.
Thank you, Wizard of Oz. Come on.
Somebody just gasped up here.
In case you didn't know, authors are very introverted people.
Yes, I am not introverted at all. I talk way too much. I'm actually going to read you, it's in the middle of the chapter of Dredging Up Memories, where this little guy came from, or gal came from. Because this is Humphrey, just in case y'all don't know, and Humphrey is Wilson in this book. So it's going to pick up in the middle of the chapter, so the first part might, what's he missing? Stick with me. Okay. Unlike in the horror movies, the hinges didn't scream. I was stunned when I stepped into the pink room. Nothing looked out of place. It was as I thought a little girl's room should be. Dolls in a playhouse in one corner, a mirror on the wall, stuffed animals on a blanket that held pictures of cartoon characters. The only thing that might have been odd was the stuffed bear lying on the floor. The one in the bunny outfit with the pic from the picture on the first floor. I picked the bear up. It was soft and plush. I've never been an overly emotional person, but the events of the weeks leading up to that point in my life had changed things considerably. Tears tugged at the corners of my eyes as I thought about the stuffed animal, about the little girl, and what probably happened to her along the way. I hugged the teddy bear close, smelling little girl soap, or shampoo, or maybe just her natural scent. I smelled the innocence I saw in the picture. It took me back to Bobby, back to a little blanket he received when he was born. It was black and white. One end lay flat over his infant body. The other end had the head of a puppy dog and two front legs that looked more like arms for hugging. I remembered how he held it tight to his chest when he got older, and Doggy no longer covered him. He took Doggy with him when... Turning on my heel, I hurried out of the room, teddy bear in hand. I closed the door behind me and made my way down the stairs. Outside, I set my pack on the porch. I opened it up and pulled out a red spray can, put a big X on the door, and placed the can back in the pack. I tucked the bear inside as well, zipping the pack on both sides so only its head poked out. "So what's your name?" I asked, knowing the silence I would receive. As if on cue, a thought popped in my head. Humphrey. The thought didn't feel right. It didn't feel like it was mine, but someone else's, as if I had stolen it from the mind of the little girl in the picture. Humphrey. I nodded, pushing away an uneasy feeling. Humphrey it is. And that's where this little girl came from.
So we have been having everybody come and take pictures with Humphrey, and if you'd like to, and if you allow us to put it on our social media, we'd like to share it with everybody. Dredging Up Memories is also available on audio. So it'll be on Audible with award-winning narrator John Malone, and he won Best Voice in Narration for Science Fiction. John Malone actually does commercials for like Kia, Ford, and does, I think, games now, right? And voiceovers. So we're very pleased that he took a chance on us. He was a little weary at first because we were brand new. It was first year we've been in business, and he said, I'm just looking to expand my range a little bit, and he ended up winning an award for it. So, okay, who's next?
I'll be next.
All right.
All right, folks, no animals were harmed in the writing of this book. I just want to preface that. This book was not easy for me to write because there are scenes in it where animals are not treated the way they should be treated. But it also showcases the bond, the unshakable, unbreakable bond that forms between a human being and a pet. And this book is kind of like a tribute to that universal love for our household pets. So after I read this, when you get home from this vacation that you're having, my advice would be to, if you have a pet, give them a big hug. Okay? So here we go. Once Stella locked Betsy inside the bathroom, whether it was like the animal knew. The few times Stella had to give the cat a bath, it had proven traumatic for the animal, and Betsy exhibited an aversion to the bathroom from then on. The cat was no doubt spooked by the warm bath water Stella was running into the tub. Steamy tendrils lifted all around the two of them as the bathroom turned thick with damp. The cat crowded herself up against the door, mewling softly up at Stella while she undressed and stood in front of the full-length mirror attached to the back of the door. Stella shushed the cat, told Betsy she loved her so much, and then proceeded to examine herself. The ruin Stella's body had become without her fully realizing. Her breasts, a full C-cup, did not disappoint her, and they never did. Stella considered them her best physical attribute. They stood at attention. But she scooped them into her hands and let them drop, and they did not fall far. But this was a wonderful thing. But then her eyes settled on the slats of her rib cage that pressed prominently upward against the starved flesh of her midsection like twin xylophones on either side of her sunken belly. Her hip bones jutted out on either side of the sticks like a kite. Malnourishment. Had she really been eating so little? She had been paying little mind to her daily caloric intake, neglect that often manifests in those who have come to concern themselves almost exclusively with survival. Every day above ground a good day, she supposed. No longer good enough, Stella would not wait out the inevitable ending. She would take charge of the when and the how. That's all there is to it. Betsy rose to full height and dug her nails into the white wood of the bathroom door. She screeched, a sound Stella had never heard from her before. It sounded remarkably like a child's cry, an infant's desperate coo. The cat glanced woefully up at Stella, and they locked eyes. What? Is your life really so great, Bets? Really? Christ, you haven't been outside the house since the day I brought you home from the pet store. You'd have a heart attack if I let you out the front door. The world is nothing but claws and teeth, Betsy. Too wild for you and too damn cruel for me. Trust me, dear, you won't be missing a thing. The animal dropped its doleful gaze to the tile floor. Stella flinched away from the mirror when her eyes found her face, pockets of discolored gray flesh bunched upward into her hazel eyes, nearly closing them. Her full lips were thin, bloodless lines, the corners downturned. She rarely looked at herself naked in the mirror, but there was no avoiding her face on a daily basis, if for no other reason than to apply spare makeup or to wash up in the morning. No need to have another look. Soon she'd look about as hot as a corpse could manage to, so what would it matter? She stepped over Betsy the cat, crossed the bathroom to where a radio was perched on the windowsill. She picked it up and walked over to the corner of the bathtub, setting it down precariously on the edge. Stella sat down on the edge of the tub and skimmed her hand across the surface of the warm water. It was high enough to submerge herself to her shoulders. Good enough, Stella turned the water off and rose. Softened by the humid air of the cramped bathroom, she stood to attention. Ready, Betsy? Betsy offered Stella one last pitiful meow. The cat crowded her body up against the door. Stella moved towards Betsy and scooped her up into her arms, and as soon as Stella turned to walk towards the tub, Betsy turned to a tangle of scrabbling claws, extended paws, and snapping jaws. She swiped at Stella's face with one paw and dug the left front claws into the tender flesh of her bare bicep, and Stella screamed. The animal screeched like an alley cat in a fight over dumpster scraps, the lower half of its fat, furry body a pendulum of rapid, frenzied motion. Stella, teeth bared herself, wrenched the animal away from her. Betsy took a sliver of flesh with her, carving a slice out of her upper arm. Stella bit her lower lip, tasting blood there instantly as she held the animal out to arm's length. Stop it, you little bitch! Stop it! They're going to kill me, and there won't be anyone to take care of you! Don't you understand? Damn you! Make the little bitch understand. Carl's voice bloomed inside her head, opening like a lotus flower inside her mind. It scared the hell out of her at first, and then she remembered what he had called this connection between them, a mind meld. It was a real thing, and somehow he had inserted himself into her conscience, skewing her morality. Carl's voice cleared out quickly as it had come, the seed buried over within her consciousness. She held the cat firmly as she stepped into the tub. The water was wonderful around her legs. The cat continued to struggle, but now Stella felt as if she had felt earlier when she had decided to stay in the car while Jack took his beating across the street. Someone else's hands had pulled the door to her car closed. Now someone else's hands grasped the animal around her sizable middle. Stella dipped down into the calm, cooling waters of the warm bath, and Betsy screamed. This time the animal sounded more infant than animal. It was unmistakable, and anyone walking by the post house just then would have paused at such a sound, fearing a child was being murdered inside. Stella shushed the cat, as she had before. The animal moaned low in her throat, her body stiffened, straight as an arrow. Stella felt the animal's entire body harden to a slippery stone. Goosebumps spread across her arms as she submerged the cat's lower paws. The cat renewed her fight at once. She shoved the animal down under. Water rose and splashed up and out of the tub, spilling across the tiles. Stella struggled with the animal. And then Stella kicked the radio off the ledge onto the tiles as her hand came up off the top of Betsy's head. The cat launched herself at the lip of the tub, scrambled stupidly with slick, sloppy paws at the side until it managed to anchor herself up and over, out of the water. It bolted to the door, saturated to half her size. Betsy, I'm so sorry. She scrambled out of the tub, bringing a wet wave of water up and out of the tub as she stumbled over the side and sloshed across the tiles to the animal. Little Betsy moaned low in her throat, bent her head low, and raised her eyes up to meet Stella's, and there was no love there. There was a naked fear. The cat trembled from head to tail. I'm so, but it was no use, of course. Stella opened the door. Betsy crammed her way through the opening and disappeared, wet paws slapping feverishly at the hardwood floor of the bedroom beyond. No use. Okay, she said to herself. I've stopped, all right? It stopped. She toweled herself off and placed the radio back on top of the bathroom windowsill. She strode back into the bedroom, not even bothering to look for the likes of the cat she had just tried to drown. It was quite possible Betsy would never come out again, not even for food. Moving around the bedroom with the mindless agility of an apparition, Stella shrugged herself into a warm sweater, jeans, and then hurried downstairs to pull on her winter coat. She returned to the kitchen, turned on the lights. The dark did not lend her any comfort as it had before, so there was no need for it. All things illuminated, ugliness and all. She located her cell phone, dumped it into her bag, scooped her keys out, and made for the door. I'm coming, hubby. Son of a bitch.
So this book is just released, and we have a special ARC here for Scares That Care, and if anybody would like one, come see us at the table, or come see Pete. He's got one right here. And the ebook is also available. Again, we had it for Scares That Care. And if you have any questions, make sure you come and see us as well. Who's next?
Do we want to give them two animals in a row?
I'll do it. Yeah. Okay, this, like I said, this was the very first thing I've ever, I did with Stitched, and it started out as an editing project, and it became a co-authorship. So, and since then, I've gotten my feet a little bit more wet in the fiction writing world. 1052 AD, Alnwick. Vladimir traveled from one village to the next, feeding on people out after dark and hiding in caves during daylight hours. 5 years of this lifestyle brought him to a place called Alnwick. The Lord of Alnwick has just passed from this plane, and his successor was a victim Vladimir fed on 2 nights after the man took over as the new Lord of Alnwick. Vladimir's coach arrived at the castle's stable and opened the door. He emerged from the ride and was greeted by the villagers, who now assumed him to be the successor. Thinking to himself, Vladimir decided this self-made problem would not become a hindrance, only an opportunity. He took no time settling into the spacious castle, then venturing out in search of an asylum. 2 villages over to the east, he found one that suited his needs. Locked deep inside the asylum was a man who appeared easy to control. At the gate, Vladimir discovered the man's name was Joseph, and he signed the proper documents for his release. Joseph, relieved to leave the torturous confines of the asylum, did not hesitate to go with Vladimir, not knowing the evil fate his so-called savior had in store for him. Days passed to nights, the nights to days, and Joseph found himself doing those horrible deeds for which his master enslaved him. Vladimir, on the other hand, began noticing something odd. Joseph would come in for his instructions as always. Vladimir would sink his fangs into the servant's neck, but the blood almost tasted tainted by something. At the bitterness of it, the vampire winced every time, and it seemed to be getting stronger with each night. One night, Vladimir drank from the victim Joseph brought. Once he finished feeding, Joseph quickly came into the room and removed the corpse, like always. This time, however, Vladimir decided to follow his servant. Joseph took the body into his room and had sex with the victim while his master secretly watched. Vladimir also discovered this happened night after night. It didn't seem to matter to Joseph if they were men or women. Vladimir took note of the gruesome discovery and realized how hard it must be to care for him alone. He knew Joseph's job was that of a lonely man. There was still enough human empathy left in Vladimir for him to know. Heart-wrenching it had to be to go out every night and retrieve victims only to come home and sleep in an empty bed or stay awake during the daylight hours with no companion. By the mid-1060s, Vladimir decided Joseph's loyal service deserved a gift. Vladimir went to Joseph and explained it was time for the loyal servant to take a wife. Of course, Joseph was beside himself with excitement, so Vladimir relieved him of his duties until his search was complete. A month nearly passed before Diana caught Joseph's eye. He fell instantly in love with her wavy brown hair and bright green eyes that reminded him of grassy fields on a sunny day. He began courting her, chasing away or killing any other suitor in his path. The courtship lasted no more than a few months before they married. However, the love affair lasted about 5 months before Joseph's jealousy reared its ugly head and impaired rational thought. He would accuse Diana of sleeping around every time she left the castle. Anger soon consumed him as he set out on his nightly hunts, fearing his woman was bedding another man. Joseph took his rage out on the victims as he nearly beat and pummeled them to death, then dragged them from the light of the streets and savagely raped them over and over again, with no concern if the victim was male or female. Vladimir saw the condition of the people Joseph brought for him to feed on, and he tasted the anger in Joseph's blood getting stronger. He once again took it upon himself to follow his servant, this time on a hunt. Keeping out of Joseph's line of sight, Vladimir observed his savage actions. The year was coming to a close, and Vladimir had not yet discovered the source of Joseph's rage until what would become the final night of his reign in Alnwick. No victim was brought to Vladimir for his feeding, and Joseph hadn't even shown up to receive his orders for the night. This enraged Vladimir, and he set out to find his wayward servant. Joseph was hiding in the shadows on a ledge near the top of a castle, looking into his bedchamber. There he saw Diana, naked on the bed, as a strange man thrust himself deep inside her, causing her to moan in a way Joseph had never heard from her, and make faces he had never seen. Joseph froze, first from sheer anger, then excitement as he listened to his wife. Silently, Vladimir slid behind Joseph and with a quick jerk sank his extended canines deep into the man's neck. No sound emanated from Joseph's lips as the images of his wife and the stranger faded from his sight, followed closely by his own life. Unfortunately for Diana, she chose that time to look out the window right into the eyes of the vampire as he bled her husband dry. Startled, she threw the man off her onto the floor and fled the room. The man slowly rose to his feet, rubbing his head when a cold breath on the nape of his neck forced him to spin around. There before him turned, stood the monster Vladimir, Joseph's blood still trickling from his lips. Vladimir took the man by the shoulders and with his free hand plunged his fist deep into his abdomen. A quick yank up split the man in two. His internal organs hit the floor in a gush of red. Vladimir dropped to the floor and began to lap at the blood like a starving dog. A sudden panic brought Vladimir back to his senses and to his feet as he realized Diana escaped the room and could be telling someone in the village what she witnessed at the castle that night. He fled into the night and vanished from Elmwick forever.
Vampires. I don't think I need the microphone. I'm pretty loud.
Okay, so Strigoi is actually, this is sort of a prequel, and she's working on taking it to a different direction, so she's expanding the universe.
The next
and,
level.
That should be available
next year.
Next year. Okay, and tell me.
All right, I'm reading from Good Boy. It's a book that Lisa first started working on me with. It's basically Watership Down with zombies. And the point, I've got a pack of Jack Russell Terriers, and they're a rabbit and cat companion. And they have left their woodchuck burrow where they lived for the past year after the brainworm plague has hit. Basically, roundworms got infected with a mutated rabies virus. So instead of going to the heart, they go to the brain. It kills humans, but it animates squirrels and makes them want to kill you. So they've been out walking in the real world. The book is told from the point of view of the lead dog in the pack. The building was once a place where the humans stored food. Now its windows were gone and the shelves were bare. The roof extended over the lot, offering a shelter from above. You never know what will be flying about at night, looking for food. We avoid the broken glass littering the black ground, fully aware it could cut our paws. Kitty keeps a constant pace just ahead of us, weaving between the poles, supporting the roof. It looks like things will go smooth until she reaches a tall metal box attached to one of the poles and stops. Kitty raises her hackles. Her hair is sticking straight up. She hisses and retreats from the box, stepping backward, 1 foot at a time. I stop in my tracks and prepare to strike at anything. The others follow, but not before maneuvering around my mate, protecting her. A chorus of low growls warns of our strength. The rabbit thumps and honks to ensure anyone who doesn't get it does. Bunny can be a brave soul with a pack of dogs surrounding him. Kitty Cat gets a safe distance from the box and stops, and I run to her side. She can smell and hear something infected in the box. My nose is dulled by the mud, blinded by what the cat indicates. She stands on her with her haunches raised, ready to pounce and strike at anything stepping out of the box. I stand alert, also ready to fight, watching the kitty for any cues she may give. The box rattles and shakes, but nothing steps out from inside it. Nothing visible, at least. A light breeze blew down the causeway, and we all discovered what the kitty was on her guard. There are a few things in the world you will never forget the smell of. The good things come to mind first. Your human master, a summer day, a tasty meal. Then there are the bad things, like spoiled meat, brain worms, and skunks. The latter is almost, but not quite as terminal as brain worms. Skunk stink fuses with you. It becomes part of you. It's a vile, sulfuric malodor to be avoided at all costs. It hovered around the metal box, an invisible barrier bearing any safe passage to anyone foolish enough to walk past its epicenter. Kitty's growl grew as loud as mine when we saw something fall out of the back side of the box. It landed on the ground with a wet plop. This was followed by another sick, dripping sound, and then another. The rest of the pack continued to huddle behind Kitty and I, encircling my mate with the bunny at her side. The cat jumps and pounces at something near us. Her claws grasp onto something I can't see in the dark, but I can smell it, as much as I can smell the skunk stench. It's unmistakable and wretched. Brain worms. But where are the infected? The others detected as well, wrinkling their noses and shirking back, tightening their circle around my mate and the bunny. Kitty swats something into the air. It flies before me, making a wet slapping sound as it bounces off the ground into the wall of the building. It's small, the size of a chipmunk, but the wrong colors, and covered in a fine coat with a striped fur, with four legs and a tail. Brainworms squirm about the thing's mouth and eyes. It struggles to its feet, the brainworms urging it on. I don't wait for it to find any prey to jump on. Holding the small body down with one paw, I rip off the head. It tastes rancid. I gag and spit it out, my jowls numb, but as my immunities work against the infection. Steam rises from my mouth as errant worms dissolve in my saliva. The cat isn't idle. She swipes and bites at the other things as they mill around the metal box. Kitty meows loudly, catching my attention. I turn my head to see something striped and hairy is falling out of the box and landed on top of her. The cat jumps back to safe distance away from it. At first it reminds me of a badger, then I realize it is indeed a skunk. It hisses and claws at the cat. Kitty stands her ground between us and the skunk. It doesn't seem to be infected. There's no brainworm sneaking about the animal's snout, ears, and eyes. The skunk twists around and raises its high tail in the air, ready to spray its noxious scent glands. Nothing happens. Instead, we are greeted with a horrific sight. Projecting out of the skunk's posterior is a pair of brainworm-infested heads and the upper torsos of a pair of the things. And I figure out what I just killed, a skunk kit. The front paws of each of the infected kits are pushing and clawing their way out of their mother's sack. They break free and fall to the ground at her feet, and the skunk's backside is a gaping hole dripping mucus and goo. I wonder how it is the kits are infected, but the mother isn't. The dire reality of the situation sets in. I look at my mate. She's still in the safeguard of our pack, but that won't save our unborn puppies from the brainworms. Without a human vet to give them the shots, it doesn't matter if they have names or not. I hope they have some immunity carried on from their mother, but I'm not confident in this. The odds are in favor of our puppies ending up with the skunk's litter of kits, carriers of the brainworms. Kitty Cat's growl alerts me to her plan. She pounces on the back of the skunk, digging her claws into the animal's side and biting her teeth deep into its neck. The skunk shakes and rolls, knocking Kitty off. I stand firm between the box and the pack, the first line of defense if the skunk breaks free of the cat. Kitty is a killing machine. She's built to be the life of the party on occasions such as this. Cats, as a rule, were born to be the ultimate carnivorous predator. Nature outfitted her for the affair with long, retractable claws and an innate sense of balance suited well for both terrestrial and arboreal tasks. Her eyes allowed her to see in almost complete darkness, and she uses these skills and abilities to herd the skunk, batting at it, taunting it, forcing it to move away from our path. And the skunk on the other paw can't see anything other than she can spit. Unable to secrete its noxious gas, she has no choice but to comply to the cat's wishes. Skittering back and through the remains of her offspring, she's also on the verge of being infected by the same brainworms once eating through her kits. The cat is too busy forcing the skunk into capitulation to notice what's going on behind her prey. I watch as brainworms evacuate the dead bodies of the skunk kits. They slither up the mother skunk's leg, entering the gaping wound on her behind. The animal twitches and shakes as the writhing worms burrow into her flesh. The skunk takes a few more listing steps, and she stops moving. She teeters for a moment and drops to the black ground in a clump. Kitty Cat and I watch and wait. We know what will come next. The brainworms are burrowing through the skunk's body, working their way to her brain. And when they arrive, the worms will take control of the skunk's motor functions, turning it into a vessel of death. The tension and anticipation builds as the moments pass, but the skunk doesn't move. Then in the distance, we all hear the distinct retort of a human gun. On cue, all of us, every dog, cat, and rabbit, turn our heads away from the skunk to the direction the crack resonated from. The echo of the shot bouncing through the empty and ramshackle structures fades to nothing. Everything is silent. We all remain still. Then I remember the infected mother skunk and turn my attention back to it. And the skunk vanished. Where could it have gone? I nudge the kitty cat and charge forward. She's as mystified as me over the disappearing skunk. We run behind the building, the moonlight shines bright on the back lot, and there's nothing but the path to the highway. And there's Kitty Cat fighting the skunk.
And so Tommy's book is coming out soon. So keep an eye out on his website. Come and see him if you need to get links to that as well.
And I have copies of pre-reader copies of Good Boy here with me this week, and I only have a few left. I brought 50, and they've been going off the shelf like pancakes at a pancake house.
Mm-hmm. And they are notated with Scares That Care.
Yeah, there's a special forward in it just for Scares That Care.
Yeah, I almost bought it twice.
You want to do something, Mike? All right.
All right, I'm going to read a short part from my book, Load. At this point, some weird things have been happening in this kind of small to mid-sized town. Some strange deaths that appear to be by animal attacks and people acting different. And our main character is a police officer named Mark Adams. This scene starts with a roll call before the shift is getting ready to start. I'll be goddamned if it ain't getting crazier than a couple of shithouse rats smoking crack out there today. All our regular nutcases are fit to be tied, sure, but we had normally sane folks losing it. Sergeant Roger Rose sat back in his chair, pulled out his handkerchief, and dabbed his forehead dry. I'm telling you, I've known Bill McCormick since he was knee high. Always had a good head on his shoulders, but today he was ranting about nightmares and people out to get him. I mean, full-on hallucinations, paranoid, schizophrenic-like. So was Wanda Bennett. Same exact shit, and they don't even know each other. Both of them had to be committed because they were talking about killing themselves. I mean, we all know we have a bunch of crazies in this city. Always have, but neither one of these folks has any history of mental illness. They just seem to have gone off the deep end, like a bunch of fucking lemons around here, all headed for some goddamn cliff. Hell, even the mental health lady was at a loss. She said her initial suspicion was acute paranoia, but didn't have a clue what set it off. He wiped his forehead again, then wiped his glasses. Anyway, better luck for y'all out there tonight, but we're out of here. Had our fill of more than a day. Oh, and somebody found Pudick's missing body. Looks like the same animal got him days ago and hid him under some brush in a ditch and they cut through behind the gas and go. Apparently, Pudick hadn't been seen in a couple of weeks or so, but somebody noticed enough to give a damn. Like anybody cared about that sumbitch anyway. Adam thought about how creepy these animal murders were as he gathered his gear and got in the patrol car. A half hour later, Megan the dispatcher's voice cracked the radio silence as he patrolled the city. Dispatch to all Zone 1 units, respond to Edward and Brock's Import Exports building at 5th and Vine. Report of a man standing on a ledge of a third-story window, possible jump. 113 direct, en route. Adams hit the lights and sirens and sped away as the others acknowledged and marked en route as well. Dexter and Greer were first on scene, advising dispatch they were parking on the north side of the building, out of sight of the potential jumper. They peeked around the corner, confirmed his location, then checked the side entrance. It was secure. 119 to dispatch, see if you can get a hold of the business owner and get them to come down here and unlock this door before we have to force entry. Also, call out our crisis negotiator. Dexter looked at Greer. Good call, man. What do you think? Stay here out of sight so he doesn't even know we might be entering? Yep. Dispatch 119. 119, go ahead. No answer from the business owner. Copy that. 119 out. Dexter, you got your hooligan tool in the trunk? Yeah, get it. Dexter nodded and scurried off to the back of his car to retrieve the hooligan tool, which fire and police often use to make entries to buildings, amongst other uses. Resembling a long, overly beefy crowbar frame, it's topped by a trio of implements, a flathead hammer, a thick pry bar, and a large pipe, which certainly makes it a versatile device. Hicks and Adams arrived out front. Adams shined a spotlight up at the guy before exiting his vehicle. The man was middle-aged, average build, nondescript, a little paunch above the waistline, balding but hanging on with a comb over. On the surface, a normal looking guy, except for his face, a contorted portrait of terror and conflicted angst. There was obviously something dogging this man's mind, something he could not escape, and facing it wasn't an option. Desperate eyes stared out over the edge at Adams, the man's butt low and pressed against the building along with his hands on each side. He looked scared of heights, afraid to jump, shaking his head back and forth in short, jittery movements as he moaned. Circumstances were volatile and exigent for sure, and it would take time for the crisis negotiator to get on scene. Adams would have to try talking the guy down. Hey, sir, he called out. What you doing up there on a nice Thanksgiving night like this? Shouldn't you be eating turkey and yam somewhere, laid up in bed, not that cold with a full belly? The man looked at him and tried to speak, closed his mouth, swallowed hard, and tried again. I'm going to jump. What in the world would you want to do that for? Let's talk about this. Tell me what's wrong. Maybe we can find a better solution. There is no other solution. I've thought it all through. I know they know. It's too late. Too late. Who knows what? Who are you worried about, sir? The man groaned, slowly building in volume, his face widening equally in dread. Oh God, I don't want to die, but there's no other way. All my co-workers know I've betrayed them to get the promotion. I can't face them. I can't face my wife. I have to jump. The man eased his weight off the building to stand erect, though still trembling head to toe. All right now, buddy, let's just think this one through. It takes a real man to admit when he's done wrong and accept the consequences for his actions. That's something your co-workers and your wife can respect. You can save face. Refuse the promotion. Come clean. Start fresh. We can all respect that. What do you think? No way. No way, man. I cannot face them. It's too much. I'm not strong enough to face them. But I can do this. Adam Stewart was spiraling out of control. Dexter popped the side door lock, prying it open with the hooligan tool. 119-113, be advised we're making entry from the side door and proceeding to the third floor. Keep him talking. Perhaps a different approach, Adam thought. All right, guy, let's say you're right. You're not strong enough. You can't face them, and taking yourself out of this world is the only way out. I still think you have a pretty big problem you haven't thought about. What the hell would that be? The man was incredulous. Well, looks to me like your whole jumping plan here isn't going to work out too well. What the fuck do you mean? I'm three stories up. That's plenty high enough, especially if I go ahead first. Well, yeah, you're three stories up. There's a bunch of bushes down here. They're just enough to cushion your fall so that you don't die but break all kinds of stuff. You want to be a cripple facing all those people? Unable to take care of yourself and having to rely on everyone who knows what you did and knows that you couldn't even kill yourself right? Well, do you? You're full of shit. I'm thinking not. Seriously, look at all the bushes down here. Does that really look like it will do the trick? The man stared down over the edge, quietly assessing his odds. 119-113, we're almost there. Keep him talking. Come on, sir. Go back inside. Meet me down here. You can talk to someone and figure out a better way. Whatever is best for you. I'll even grab you some turkey and mashed potatoes or something for while we talk. How about it? The man appeared to slump back against the wall. His eyes squeezed so tightly it twisted his face into pure despair. He appeared defeated, shaking his head slowly, some unholy nightmare playing out on the insides of his eyelids. Suddenly, he looked sharply at the window on his right as if he heard something. Recognition dawned. I don't think so, officer. I can't live another moment like this. They won't let me. A surge of confidence rushed across his face as he made peace with his final decision, and his body swelled with adrenaline courage. His legs pulled from despair to determination, arms bending like springs before he launched himself out into the night, diving headfirst in the hill. Adam sucked wind and held his breath involuntarily until the man's body impacted with the concrete sidewalk, just barely clearing the bush line. There was a loud crack, like a steel ball bearing being thrown against the cement wall as the skull met the pavement. His body toppling over as joints and tissue gave way to gravity's unyielding follow-through. Adam stared at the body, mere feet in front of him, the pool of dark, visible blood expanding in a slow pool around the man's head and shoulders, bits of skull and gray matter floating along, the moon and streetlights reflecting in the crimson flow. Adams looked up and saw Dexter and Greer looking down, shaking their heads. Fuck, was all Adam said at first. Hicks called for EMS and told him to call the detective and cancel the crisis negotiator. Fuck me, Adams mumbled and squatted down, running his hands through his hair. Hicks came over to him and placed his hands on his shoulders, a sergeant reassuring his man. It's okay, Mark. You tried, man. You tried real hard. Better than I could have done. I know that for sure. It was his decision. You didn't do anything wrong. I got your back. Adam stood and turned back to the car. I appreciate that, Sarge. It means a lot. Adams pulled the crime scene tape from his trunk and started cordoning off the area. Hicks knelt by the guy's body, fishing in his back pocket for a wallet. "So who is he?" Adams asked. Hicks flipped over the wallet and located the driver's license. "Harry. Harry Fitzwill, age 46. "Holy fuck, Hicks. That's the guy Amy said came in the ER the other day acting all weirded-eyed and talking suicidal. Shit. Man, that's some coincidental shit there. Look, take a seat in your cruiser and start writing a report. I got the stuff, and I'll coordinate with Detective Andrews when he gets here. The sooner we're done, the sooner I can let you off earlier." Adams glanced around, dejected. Epic fail, the only descriptor for his life right now. Vehicles were starting to slow to a crawl as they passed by, staring, trying to ascertain what might have happened. Steal a glance of darkness normal people rarely see. On the perimeter, standing calmly, munching on a cheeseburger, was a scraggly-looking homeless guy, dressed in a worn sports jacket and jeans. He smiled at Adams, stared at the body again, then took another bite. Adams thought he might have seen the guy before, but couldn't really make out his features. His mind released the puzzle quickly and moved on, not even trying to hold on to the memory under the circumstances. Adams headed to his car, the blood seeming to slowly follow him until the little red soldiers no longer marched forth from the wound. That homeless man is critical to the story.
Poor Pudik.
So Low is the first novel from Mike Duke that we published. It is available in Barnes & Noble. It's available online. And we are working on getting it on audio. So if you'd like to hear more about Mike Duke, please go to his table, which is with Tommy, and find out more from him. So we're going to wrap this up, but I was requested to read from The Unfleshed. One of the hardest things, maybe Jeff, you can relate to this, that a mentor can do is put their own stuff out there, because you have a lot of pressure. A lot of pressure and a lot of eyes on you. My book is more medieval style. It's set in the Black Plague. It's my homage to Shelley's Frankenstein. And it's my own take on it. It's alternate history, science fiction. So in this scene, because I'm going to cut it short, I don't want to go over anybody else's time. In this scene, Angus, who is the big bad wolf, he is the doctor in the village. He has a faithful companion who he's found out has not been so loyal to him. He has him locked in the cellar. And Marshall, who is the faithful companion, is begging for his forgiveness. "You seek my forgiveness then?" Angus finally responded. "Yes, yes, please. I will do whatever you ask." Angus smiled. A gesture made more sinister with the animated shadows of candlelight dueling with the darkness on his features. It made Marshall's heart leap into his throat. "Then let's discuss penance." The doctor was already moving forward as he spoke, and Marshall's bowels watered. He could not imagine in his worst moment what horrors the doctor could conceive of to atone for his fall from grace. But he knew he was about to find out. Watching the mad doctor approach, Marshall could see the short, curved blade glistening in the candlelight. Angus brought one of the candlesticks over and displayed the sharp edge. "Are you a man of your word, Marshall?" Marshall's jaw chattered despite his efforts to maintain a level of calm. Yes, sir, I am." "That's good." Angus purred out in a slow drawl. The doctor passed the blade over the tiny flame of the candle, heating it up. "I demand recompense for what you've done," Angus announced. Marshall's eyes opened so wide they ached. He watched the other man move along the table where he was strapped to and stand by his ankles. The doctor observed his helpless prey like a hungry wolf, true to his surname. Marshall tried not to whimper or let out a cry, but it filled his throat regardless of his effort. Each movement Angus made was slow and deliberate, so Marshall could follow along without missing anything. The doctor then extended his arm way back, facing the tip of the blade toward the ceiling. "Are you going to give it to me?" Angus asked. Marshall's prayers turned into screams of silent fear within his thoughts. He willed his muscles to obey and give a convincing performance.
The longer the blade hovered above them both, the more his panic grew until finally, Angus brought his blade down in a swift arc, slicing through Marshall's breeches. The material fell away, exposing the man to the cool air around them. The merchant let out a cry of anticipation and terror. He felt the precision of the blade skate along his outer thigh, barely nicking him. The momentum of the blade's direction caused Marshall's pant leg to flap away from his skin. Angus stood in silence for a moment. He wanted Marshall to process everything he did. When Marshall stopped screaming, he was panting. With his hands still tethered, he jerked down at the rope, wanting to protect his groin. His eyes were wide and wild as he thrashed about. When he calmed down and his head fell back to the table with a heavy thud, Angus remained quiet and patient. He waited for the mental process to take its toll. Marshall began to sob, then laugh until he became hysterical. When Angus's patient was adequately distracted, the doctor gripped the other man's testicles. Marshall's laughter came to an immediate silence. Staring up into the abyss of Angus's eyes, he watched as the doctor lifted his arm high above his head and brought the scalpel down, carrying with it the sting and tear of his scrotum. Shock held his scream a prisoner. The skin on Marshall's scrotum split open, and with a firm squeeze of Angus's fingers, the meat within the sack was extracted to the chorus of Marshall's released screams and violent retching. Vomit flew from his lips like a fount, while the doctor continued his vice-like grip, ensuring the man didn't bleed out. A few splashes of spittle stained on the apron he wore, but he was never bothered by it. He seemed to have all the time in the world. In the meantime, Marshall flopped and twitched on the table in his own excrement and bile. The doctor finally lifted the bulbous prize to show Marshall and watched victoriously as the man choked on his sobs. Marshall flailed against his binds and tried to reach out for Angus, but it was no use. Marshall strained his neck, trying to pull his body off the table surface. The cords on either side of his throat were stretched to the limit, and his abdomen burning in pain before his head fell back. The exertion of all his strength induced a wave of fatigue. He had no fight left in him. Docile as a lamb, he continued to cry in utter silence until he slipped into the oblivion of unconsciousness. Just to let you guys know, if you're interested in Stitch Mile, we do have the table in the corner. We do mentoring. A couple of us do it up here. And what we do is we try to teach our authors to give back by mentoring. So if there's somebody that whose writing style is a lot like yours or you really like, please see us. We also have editors who are always willing to help. And anything you guys need, we'll be happy to help. Thank you.
You can find the Necrocast account all over social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as the Necrocast account. I'm at Token Bottom Score Tom on Twitter, Tommy Clark on Facebook, or Tom Clark Author. Find me there as well. What about you, Scott?
You can find me on my ever-growing, totally awesome, super sexy YouTube channel, Mr. Scott Reacts, where I do reaction videos to music and try not to challenges and a lot of epic rap battles of history lately, too, which are getting me the views. So thank you all out there for subscribing. And you can also find me on Twitter under at Mr. Scott Reacts as well.
Walter Ball, Smoking Walt Ball, what about you, sir?
You can find me on Twitter at YourWaltBall, and you can find me on the Instagram at Smokin_Walt_Ball.
Damn, we're coming closer to your retirement as a pro wrestler.
Yes, you can, and the absolute last time you're going to see me in the ring is Friday, October 25th, Monster Mania 2019. That's going to be the Alden Murder House, Eric and Shane Alden versus Pain and Fury, which is the World of Hurt heavyweight champion Tyler Payne and the United States champion Sergeant Fury in a steel cage at the Halloween show. So there's no better way. And also there is lining up to be a very special guest referee. So it's absolutely awesome. And I hope everyone turns out for that. You can find me on both Twitter and Instagram at the Sergeant Fury. And you can find my podcast, Films of Fury, wherever you get your fine-ass podcasts, and on Facebook at FOF Podcast.
And with us as well, Lisa Vasquez, where can people find you, the Unsightly Queen, and all of your followers for Stitch Smile Publications?
So Stitch Smile Publications is on Twitter and Instagram. Instagram is Stitch Smile Publications. Twitter is House of Stitched. You can find me at Unsightly unsaintly.wiki, and I'm also at unsaintly.com, and my Facebook is Facebook Lisa Vasquez Official, and there are so many places for you to find us on Facebook, whether you join our VIP groupies for those who are diehard fans, the ones who are always getting interaction with the authors. If you're really interested in engaging the authors, that's where you need to be. You can find that easily on Facebook. And then we have, of course, our public page, which is Stitch Mile Publications.
Right. That is awesome. It's everywhere.
And if you're nice, Lisa will give you swag.
Yes.
If you're nice.
Yes.
Tons of swag.
I have awesome stickers. Stickers are big right now, and I have some really awesome stickers, and they were everywhere at the con, so I was so excited.
There's one right on my laptop.
You gotta be awesome like me in order to get, like, for Lisa to give you, like, horror trivia games and stuff. I get that stuff.
Yes. And you notice that they had that at Scares That Care? I was like, I did it first. Hello. I did it first. Yes.
Often imitated, never duplicated.
That's right. I actually pre-ordered those horror trivia games and waited a month before I was able to give them out.
They're fun. It's not like a giant board game either. It's just really the cards and dice. So I grab it and just hit my wife with a trivia question, like, while she's not even in the middle of like, thought. And she's like, you got to put something
out. They got that relationship. They're like that.
They're awesome for, like, the road trip to Scares, sitting at dinner with friends, or, you know, just kind of hanging out, watching horror movies with your friends, Netflix and chill, whatever. They're really cool. We used to do family day back in the day, real quick. And we would just pick up the cards and kind of sit down and just ask each other questions. Or, like, if we were at a restaurant, we would pick them up because people were always on their phones. So we would ban our phones. And this was, like, conversation starter. So now I've got the horror version. I'm like, hell yes, man. That's awesome.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on the... What is this? Gosh. What chapter is this on the Necrocasticon again? Oh, it's chapter 18. Chapter 18 of volume 5. Wow.
Wow, five volumes.
Five volumes, 18 chapters in. It's 18 awesome. Episodes in. So thank you very much, Lisa Vasquez, once again, for your honored presence here on the Necrocasticon.
Yes, thank you.
Always fun to be here.
And this chapter of the Necrocasticon is...
Closed. The Necrocasticon is an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network. Written and produced by Thomas Clark, Scott Grovesty, Walter Ball, and Dan Roberts. Music provided by Daniel Edenfield.
My Favorite Story, a podcast author anthology featuring short fiction from the hosts of the Project Entertainment Network shows
Three Guys with Beards,
Jim Moore, Jonathan Maybar, and Chris Golden,
Tom Clark from Necrocast, Igbon,
Brian Keene of The Horror Show,
Chuck Buddha, and Armand Rosamilia of The Mando Method,
Mary San Giovanni of Cosmic Shenanigans,
Jay Wilburn from Matters of Faith,
John Urban Sick of Ink Stains,
Bill Zung's Mr. Frank,
available on Kindle and in paperback and through the Project Entertainment Network store.
www.projectentertainmentnetwork.com.
Thank you for coming to the Project Entertainment Network store. Please place your order. A good choice. A t-shirt for The Horror Show with Brian Keene. A Mando Method coffee mug. There's more. A Necrocast Icon hoodie. That's sharp. But why on earth would you want Bizong leggings? Wait. Are you Mr. Frank? The Project Entertainment Network store, stacked with goodies from all your favorite podcasts. T-shirts, hoodies, mugs and more.
www.projectentertainmentnetwork.com.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.